Thanks. To just give some context for folks who might not have been at our previous sessions, I studied at Luther College, and Luther has a study abroad program in northern Tanzania for a month in January, where we go and learn about really the content of this particular session is kind of the focus of the course. So it's talking about tourism and conservation, how that's impacting Maasai culture. And one of the three guides and teachers for that program, in addition to the faculty from Luther, is Kilingat. And I met Kilingat when I went on this program in 2014. And he invited me to come back for his wedding a few years later. And then after a couple of years, we figured that it's probably time that Kilingat come to the United States and share with folks here. So he's been at Luther, he's been in Washington, D.C., and then he's been at Holden for the last month. And the previous two sessions talked about, first, just an overview of Maasai history and culture. The second one was the relationship of traditional Maasai religions and Christianity. And then this session will focus on conservation in Maasai culture. And I think this is, of pretty much anyone who's here, this is probably one that we have participated in the most. Because chances are, if you've gone to Tanzania, chances are if you've gone to Kenya, you've gone on safari. And what we'll learn today is how that is pretty heavily impacting the Maasai people and culture. So Kilingat will speak and deliver the presentation. I'll jump in a couple of times just with some information and sketches, and then at the end we'll have plenty of time to discuss, in particular, kind of the relationship of this issue and what we're doing as Americans in either forwarding this or preventing it. That's all I have.
Hello. Good afternoon. I'm very happy to talk to you again. This is, I think it's my last class and my last day in the pandemic, so I'm excited. But this is one of my interesting topics, because I grew up in the, you know, in the natural kind of setting where the Maasai live dependent from nature. So I have been experiencing it with what is all about conservation, not from teaching, but experience, you know. So today we learn about conservation and Maasai culture. So one of the things that you have to know is that Maasai culture is based on what we call pastoralism. And pastoralism is actually taking care of cattle, as I said from the previous class, in a nomadic way. So when we talk about nomadic, that means the Maasai can move from where they live to the valley or to the mountain or to the jungle or to the plains, to make sure that they access natural resources. And these natural resources are grasses, water, and salt licks. So that's why we say in a nomadic way, or in a semi-nomadic way, because nature provides all these kind of resources in order for us to survive with our livelihood. But conservation, to me, is an isolation of wild animals in an identified territory. And this is what happened, that the wildlife has to be isolated. The wildlife has to be cut off from human, you know, kind of core existence. It doesn't matter, history shows that maybe these people were living together with wild animals. So we have the earth that provide survival for us. So there are some of the elements of earth that they are very important to our survival. So the three of the fourth elements of the material world, water and fire, for example, God gave the Maasai people this fourth element of the material world. God took the fourth element of himself, that means the omnipresent air. And water, woods, and the other materials of earth natural resources for survival in Maasai settings and in Maasai beliefs and in Maasai understanding. So this kind of elements of the material world, we can say they are like dual fertility of material world. That means it recognizes the Maasai recognize them from depending from this material world for survival. That means the mother of earth is a miracle of fertility, according to the Maasai people. Now, Maasai map of Tanzania and like its national parks. That is Tanzania. So all the red small drawings are some of the biggest national parks found in the country. So this kind of conservation or the national parks are coming, and we have the traditional system of Maasai that recognize the forest, the wilderness, and the other material world as the board of ancestors. The religious function of nature were assured in Maasai settings. At the beginning of time, the Maasai first neighbors were the animals. So we can actually assume here, or we can probably think and say, they probably hunted some, but there is an overwhelming evidence show that they have let the multitude rule the wilds. The paradise of wildlife in Maasai land is the overwhelming evidence of the world right now. In Maasai tradition, animals are souls. They can either be good or evil, holy or profane. So, the natural conservation of Maasai had begun with the boundary of nature, which make the tropical savanna of East Africa the Garden of Eden. So the tropical East Africa kind of climate is regarded as Garden of Eden. Why? Because the soil is so fertile. And there is a joke in East Africa that when you dig your fingers into the soil, your fingernails will begin to grow. So this Garden of Eden, the Maasai only recognize it by accessing the natural resources, but not digging the Garden of Eden in forms of agriculture, like other tribes doing in the tropical east of East Africa. So there is a joke, as I said, and actually this kind of joke is a notion showing that the Maasai are not agriculturalists because they don't cultivate the land. And opening a huge land for agriculture, the Maasai believe, is a crime against nature. And if the necessity is the mother, so let's think as humans, that if the necessity is the mother of invasion, abundance is the mother of nature. Where nature is so bountiful, where men of pastoralist society, that means the Maasai in tropical savanna, need advanced innovation. That's one of the things we have to see and learn each other. Nature has been so kind to us in Maasai savanna, and because nature has been so kind, nature helped me to make another decision for the Maasai people. What kind of decision? They never developed it into a centralized kingdom. But their social organization was very informal, more relaxed, precisely because of the boundary of nature. So it's so interesting that this boundary of nature also taught us we have never learned to live in luxury, but to live on what the nature gives us. The Maasai call biodiversity sao-sao. That is the name of biodiversity in our language. So in my language, sao-sao is so important. So the importance of biodiversity sao-sao to the Maasai people has culminated the Maasai to be real conservationists in relation to their taboos, social norms of conservation. So we have a lot of taboos that the Maasai traditional methods can prove to the people that these taboos has been limiting, has been prohibiting them from destroying some species of plants and animals. And these taboos has culminated to the preservation of these species. So the Maasai community and their natural beliefs, they have a totem, for example. So, pastoralism, the Maasai way of life, so cows, sheep, and goats matters in Maasai survival. And why? Because they provide food that we only consume. So if we eat meat, we drink milk, so and eat honey or wild fruits, the Maasai has no need to get wild meat again. So that's why we don't have it for wild meat. So, for example, a totem is a plant or animal species used by community as their symbol. Among the most totems respected by the Maasai are the number of trees, animals like elephants, baboons, head elk, aardvark, pangolin, tortoise, and hippopotamus. These animals are among of the animals that can be taken by the Maasai beliefs that they are holy or profane, they are good or evil. Members of a particular Maasai people were not allowed to harm that particular plant or animal species because they are either good or evil or holy or profane, and this lead to the conservation of these species. Because it is so important, according to this belief that has been integrated to our culture. Why Maasai livestock and environment matters? So we are exploring why the Maasai animals and environment matters. Maasai graze livestock in an environment in the form of accessing the natural resources, as I say. Those are the natural resources, grasses, nutritious leaves, water, and salt licks. So all the resources are acquired in nomadic way. They move in search of these resources. Question now comes into relation to what we are going to see that between modern conservation and mass natural conservation. So why wild animals move for natural resources and not Maasai domestic animals? So some of the notions has been developed that now the Maasai domestic animals have no right to accept the natural resources, but wild animals do or does. So if wild animals move for such of these resources, it doesn't matter what is happening in a certain setting, geographical of land. And if there is no any resources in that particular land, animals move where the rainfall is found, or is raining, or where the food is found. So that notion has been a controversy in conservation. Attending livestock in general is a mode of our life. You see that seawater. We need that small dam for using our own hands to make sure that we collect water for livestock. So water is important. But actually it's very interesting that water has been one of the resources that is so scarce or involved with the ironies of nature. So some of the places that are so prone with flowing of rivers and, you know, the streams of water should at the same time be the place for only one side. That means only wild animals. So the people who livelihood have no right to access these natural resources. So these are some of the ironies of nature. Well, the irony is happening according to our own creation. The lifestyle of Maasai defines social responsibility, that means pastoralism. So, as I said, women are the miracle of versatility in our culture, because they milk cows, they collect fire, fetch water, cook, take care of children. So, they have the dual fertility, these women in Maasai culture. That these women can be defined as a miracle of versatility of a woman, the species. It's very important. And it's very, very powerful. Girls can also head cattle, but mainly help their mothers at home. Mostly girls who go for heading are mostly for the family, that the father didn't have boys alone. So they go also for heading. Boys head cattle, sheep and goats. Warriors protect the head and society. So those are the warriors. So among of those guys, you see them there. One of them is my brother. From the right, the first one standing there. So they play to their hair. They are very proud of the Maasai proud culture. They have a lot of clubs and spears. So a huge king of the jungle cannot say anything in front of them. So they carry all those, you know, cultural weapons for protecting the wildlife and the people. Natural conservation of the Maasai, the Maasai called biodiversity, as I said, Selsel, and the importance of Selsel is so enormous, as I say. The animals in Maasai have souls, either good or evil, holy or profane. The Maasai taboos towards animals and preservation of species. There are plants and animals that are totem. Then, hence, preservation. Maasai natural conservation, their heads interacting with the wildlife. So that man is herding cattle. That means all those cattle are going to access the natural resources from the natural environment. Maasai lands gradually to be national parks. This is one of the problems happening. So the Serengeti National Park, Ngorongoro Caldera or Crater, Lake Manyara National Park, Tarangire National Park, Mkomazi National Park, Kilimanjaro National Park, Arusha National Park. All those national parks in the Maasai were living inside, but they were evicted, they were pushed out of the land. Ngorongoro Conservation Area. So, in those all national parks, the only area that is defined in a very sweet word of conservation is Ngorongoro Conservation Area. Because when Serengeti National Park was formed in 1959, so the Maasai were moved and they were given to stay in Ngorongoro, and they were told nobody will ever touch you again. But one of the leading places that has a larger population, for example, of lions, elephants, and rhinos, is in Ngorongoro Conservation Area, where the Maasai live and wildlife at the same time. So this iconic place on Earth, it is the 8th wonders of the world, because the area is accommodating humans and wildlife at the same time in the rim of the crater, not inside the crater. They were living inside the crater, but they were also moved. But at least they live there. So this Ngorongoro Conservation Area could be one of the evidence to show that human and wildlife can exist. And the Maasai only are the only people living in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. Now, a large part of Maasai settlement is near the boundary of protected areas. So if you see a Maasai boma like that, they live very close to the national park. So the places that has been declared as protected areas. So now look there. The zebras alongside the Maasai livestock in the Maasai rangelands, they are grazing. so all kind of antelopes. If you go to Maasailand, you see all kind of antelopes, the zebras, wildebeests. They're grazing along the Maasai livestock. Why? Because these animals feel that they are protected. Because they know the Maasai people don't kill them. Because they know the Maasai people, with their cattle, will protect them against the predators. So they everywhere. So it's very interesting that why the wildlife move out of the protected area national park to the Maasai rangeland, but the Maasai animals cannot move to the national park. It's very interesting actually. Coexistence between wildlife and livestock. So the Maasai are the only people proved on earth that they can live in harmony with wildlife. So there you see Maasai animals and a rhino is grazing ahead. And that guy is just being, is just looking cows going and the rhino is there. When modern conservation arrived to Maasailand, so what happened? So when conservation happened, arrived to Maasai country, Tanzania has 16 national parks right now. So the largest are from Maasailand, as I mentioned. So like the total landmass of one national park, you can imagine how the square kilometers of land was taken. So if you calculate them, the larger part of the national wildlife is from Maasailand. The total landmass in Maasai, over 40% of land is protected areas. So you take 60% and divide with the cities, construction of roads, infrastructures, human settlement that has no, that are not impressing, let's say, you know, the lesson, what other people say, primitivity way of life, but they are impressive modernity. The cities are growing, the towns are growing, and also take about the agriculture, what do they do for survival? So you can calculate and see that conservation is taking a huge land, and that's my fear in the future about wildlife and the people. Every protected land lies adjacent to human settlement, and this always causes conflict due to competition of resources from the land. Conservation laws, policies are biased. Why? Because they evict people from the land. So if these people think that to, you know, to conserve wild animals, it is to exclude people, the native people, out of their land. That's what they think, that's what they believe. Animals are given status and values than human beings and their livelihoods right now. So like, it's very interesting. In Ngorongoro Conservation Area, they do a crossbreeding of rhinos to increase the number of rhinos. But when a rhino gets old, the rhino is so much protected and fed. So this one rhino in Ngorongoro Conservation Area that use 50 million a day for feeding it and doing, you know, veterinary service to it. But finally, you realize that the people who are living in Ngorongoro, sometimes they experience famine in the presence of green dollars for people who are coming to watch wildlife. It's an irony. So why this is happening? Because when capitalism as a model production arrived, the model of conservation changed. Capitalism suggested making a profit out of animals. And the Maasai are behind that calculation. Hunting came with other motives. Hunting conservation also is growing large. The motives of slaughter of elephants, for example, and the other endangered species or rare species, came. This is happening because the motivation of science is to kill animals to maintain a balance in the environment. Or capitalism kills for commercial returns. Science wants to ensure that there is no more elephants and the other 100 animals than the environment can support. Private enterprises look for profit, dead or alive. That's a problem. When hunting tourism persists, animals caught in between, and many Maasai people know hunting is cruel, and few people in the world understand even less, because what the Westerner think of Serengeti, Ngorongoro and the other destination, they only know safaris in Tanzania. They think these destinations as wide open plains teeming with wild animals, the greatest plains with abundance of animals and the enigma of nature. So that's what the people know. But they don't know that the elephants are shot, the rare species and endangered species are killed in the name of capitalism or in the name of science. It's crazy. And natives living near these protected areas were evicted. They don't know that they were evicted. And they think that the ecosystem protected areas are at the very heart of the plains of savannah and are the painful stories of survival. That's what we know, that we are living in a savannah under the painful stories. All across the savannah, the same thing is happening. That means killing, hunting for trophies, and displacement of people in their ancestral land in the name of conservation. So, forms of national parks or protected areas in Tanzania. So we have national parks, as I mentioned there, conservation areas, conservation area Ngorongoro, game control areas like the Loliondo where I'm coming from, Lake Natron, Longido, etc., game reserve, Selous, wildlife management areas like Western Serengeti, Lake Natron, Nyara Range, national monuments including marine parks. So those are the forms of conservation, and every word is giving it, it has its own kind of laws and policies. But at the same time, these are the sweet words of conservation at the same time. There's no single word of conservation, we can face that. Serengeti National Park, former land. So that is, you can see Serengeti is really huge. And from there you see the border between Tanzania and Kenya. So you see Maasai Mara Game Reserve. It's one of the other 8 wonders of the world. The Maasai live on the other side in Kenya. So you see the way the Maasai, the places the Maasai were living. That's why the animals is there. So Serengeti and Maasai Mara, I can say, is the second largest park in the world after Kruger National Park in South Africa. So that was Serengeti National Park.
Where do you live, Kenya?
I live in Loliondo. Okay, Loliondo Game Control Area. I live in East Serengeti. That's where I live. So Loliondo Game Control Area is a part of another form of conservation where we have a lot of crisis of land conflict. So Ngorongoro Conservation Area, Maasai live with wildlife in harmony, as I said. So those are the Maasai cows near the Ngorongoro crater rim. So there you see a lot of animals, but between them you see all types of antelopes, zebras, wildebeests grazing together as Maasai cows. Laws and policies of conservation in Tanzania. So the government, one of the laws is that the government may extend protected areas anytime they wish. And this is what they are doing. They don't think about the variables, that means the people. They only think about extended boundaries. And within the same boundaries, some people, rich people, take small concessions for like putting maybe lawyers or tents. I don't know. Laws of national park, no any human activity allowed in a national park. Those are the laws. Hunting laws. Hunting is allowed by the Tanzania laws. That means the minister responsible for animals made a strict grant license and permits for hunting. He can do that, and the law does allow. There is a presidential favor too, a favor permit for hunting. This always is taken by the nobles, royals, and the other former famous rich people. So the president can also grant a permit for you to go to shoot animals. And mostly taken in a sacred way. But the law does allow the president to give the permit. Paradox of conservation. Merits of conservation. Apart from this, we have merits of conservation. One is employment in the hotels industry. So many people are employed. Revenues to the central government, to the tourism industry, because tourism industry is the second largest for economy, after minerals. Preservation of endangered species, it is happening. By the same time, they're hunting. Scientific studies. A lot of scientific studies is going on. And at the same time, there are some of the animals over the hunting for research. Employment in traveling agents. So that is inside, I'm going to go create a picnic area. So those are the jeeps entering the main. So that's a picnic. So every car there must have a driver. If you come to Longora Crater, you are not allowed to drive yourself. It's a Tanzanian, they are described by the law that they don't have to drive you down the mountain and see the animals inside there. So many people are employed who are also traveling against. Hunting conservation in Africa. Types of hunting. I was trying to figure out and see, according to my experience, to see the types of hunting. So there's one cultural hunting. So like the Maasai hunt lions. Bush people, like in the Kalahari Desert, for example, and the Tatoga and the Barbai in Tanzania who live in the bush, they also hunt for bush meat. And it has been alive since the millennium. So they do that for survival. But the modern conservation undermined and banned by the government conservationists is this kind of hunting. So it's quite different. The Maasai hunting of lion and the other bush people is quite different because the Maasai hunt lions for cultural beliefs, as I've shown you from the previous class. But those people, they do for survival, for eating and live. But they have been coupled from that kind of survival. Hunting for trophies is also happening. So licenses for game hunting and land concession for legitimate land use, that means hunting. So when trophy hunting, these companies must take the land for hunting. And they say it's a legitimate land use. That means for hunting. But the bush people, it is not a legitimate land use for hunting and survival. It contradicts. Hunting for cats, elephants, and the other wild animals for different purposes, like scientific studies, for example. So, and the elephants at the same time are hunted, you know, in so many different ways. It's crazy. There's also poaching. So poaching is, they say, is illegal hunting. But it is happening in a conservation survey, in the presence of conservationists. And why? So let's think, like, why there is a huge wide market, like in Asia, to buy all the products of animals hunting. So why can't we, like, say if in poaching is illegal, so why there is a market for illegal poaching, for what we are people selling? And who is capable, think, who is capable to transport all these products of animals and illegally to cross all international airports to Asia or to America or to Europe or anywhere? Who is capable to do that? Crazy. The outcome of trade and markets for animal products, so this is happening, and there is an outcome of trade and markets for animal products. Are this happening all the way? I believe so. Concepts for hunting and conservation. So hunting advocates and some conservationists argue that if hunting is done responsibly, the selling of expensive lenses to be game hunters can help to pay for efforts to protect endangered species. So these are the concepts of, you know, hunting. They say if we sell this license for game hunting, for, you know, hunting for trophies, it can help us protect endangered species. How? While so many, you know, the big hunters people are interested to shoot cats. Hunting helps to support the balance of wildlife and the environment. They tell us that too. But also hunting helps in scientific research and curiosity. Those are the concepts of hunting. Consequences of hunting. So, for example, in 2009, International Union for the Conservation of Nature reported hunters killed 600 lions in a year. That is their research. So, may I have the
next slide?
So, I want to show you something, for example, that is very interesting. So, the Maasai lions hunting, for example, I remember when we were warriors, we, for more than 10 years, we killed 12 lions. So let's say every generation of Maasai warriors, for the number of 15 years, maybe they kill 12 lions for the cultural pilgrimage, right? Then calculate only for, let's say, 6 generations after 15 years, how many lions are killed. And compare with the figure in a year, only 1 year, of International Union for Conservation of Nature. Now, the hunting of Cecil. There was a very, very famous lion in Zimbabwe called Cecil. In July 2015, by Dr. Walter James Palmer. This guy is coming from Minnesota, I think.
Yeah.
So Cecil was very famous, I'm sorry, but we are trying to share, you know, learning. So Cecil was very famous because Oxford University was doing research about his family in the sanctuary in the refuge in Zimbabwe. So it was very famous. So when it was hunted, the same scientists were very possible to track Cecil. So Cecil was found dead. And this Cecil death created international controversy. I think I have seen, when I was in Tanzania, I saw some of the people in Minnesota were like demonstrating and writing a lot of flyers to tell Palmer that you're a lion killer. I saw that. Because I always follow a lot of issues of conservation a lot. So, Palmer paid, for example, $50,000 to bring Cecil down with the bow and the arrow in a private wildlife refuge bordering the park. So, if you, this kind of, you know, like, it's a private concession, blah, 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 is one of the things that contributing to the diminution of wildlife. So, Palmer became a target of international vigilantism, you know, internet, you know. He said, I quote what he said from New York Times. He said, I relied on the expertise of my local professional guides to ensure illegal hunting. So that was illegal, right? But Oxford University and so many conservationists were mad against him. But also, the court in Zimbabwe arrested the guides, then later withdrew the case, and the saga didn't end lion hunting in Africa. That was very crazy. So that is Palmer, the left, and that was Cecil. Other images of trophy hunting.
Oh my God.
Challenges of conservation to Maasai way of life. So Maasai displacement in their ancestral land in the name of conservation result loss of land, resources, water, grazing, etc. It's one of the consequences of challenges to us. Hence, eviction culminated in Maasai to be conservation refugees. Right now, we are refugees a lot because of the results of conservation. Eviction. Those were the our bombers in 2017 in my village. So there was a banning because the government is to evict us to give a company from Dubai to shoot animals. Mm. Banning is going on in the name of conservation. That was our village. And it was crazy. These paramilitary forces were like coming with a petrol and put all the houses and go very far and shoot in the very far distance. The houses. Hunting conservation and land conflict. So that is my land, the area. So the guy talking on top of the car is the regional commissioner of Arusha. He was going to do the new demarcation because that resulted to the burning you saw, and the women and people blocked the road, telling him you cannot demarcate our land. In that group, my mother is there, but it's very hard to see her. So they were blocking and raising their voices. But still, it is happening because money is the first priority to our life. To some individuals, to some people. Livestock and wildlife conflicts is another challenge. So, like for example, lions attack and kill mass livestock, revenge can happen to lions. And mostly, it's very interesting that, for example, there was one saga in Kenya. In Nairobi National Park, which is very close to the city, the lions get out of the park and kill more than 200 goats from Maasai. So the Maasai were demonstrating they were going to kill these lions. So the government sends the forces to prevent the muscle from killing lions, which is really very interesting. So all the media in the world, you know, took this story, but I was really surprised to see that all the media world was against the Maasai. And it's because people raise stories in another different way. They don't have a, they only have a single story, not a single story. But finally, these Maasai warriors were listening to the government. And the government knew they were going to kill them. And also they were sending the forces to see maybe if the Maasai would be scared away. But there was no scared away. Finally, there was an understanding, which I like the ideas of President of Kenya. He's very diplomat. Different from where I'm coming from, President. Disease caused by wild beast to livestock. So when wild beast give birth to babies, they actually, I don't know, they transmit a certain kind of disease to our livestock. But there is no any research show that the Maasai livestock can harm wildlife either through diseases or any other way. But our way of life can accommodate wildlife. Competition of resources is also another challenge. Human and wildlife conflicts too is another challenge. When people are attacked, injured, or killed by animals, sometimes there are no conversation, or nobody will do anything, or nobody cares. But if you find a lion is lying along the road, you are not allowed to scream to it. Let it stay there. When elephants destroy people's crops, this is for other communities. One of the most destructive animals I ever seen is the elephants. And mostly when they get out of national parks, we don't work with them, but so many communities living near the national parks and their crops are destroyed. Maybe for a year they have nothing from what they have produced. And nobody cares, maybe. Well, they care, and by showing they care, they run away. So, torture, arrest, cattle, seizing when Maasai overstep the mark of protected areas. So, that boy was shot by the rangers in your village because he was, you know, the problem is in the area I am living, where the government failed to evict us because they burn our homes every year. And when they burn, we go back. Because we don't have anywhere to go. So now, the way they do is to make sure that all our livestock, all our livelihood is no longer existing. In order, we are not part in economy. Because cows give us, you know, the... So if you don't have cows, at least we run away from the environment. I don't know to survive how. But I think if all the massive cows will come to an end, I think we go back to the national park, we eat those animals. That's what I think. That's why there is no sustainable kind of conservation in that kind of excluding or evicting people. There's no future of that conservation. So this guy was resisting his cows. These rangers were taking the national park because if they were like taking, seizing all these cows to the national park, and they were not in the national park, imagine. But take them in order to call journalists and declare that these cows belong to the government. These are the atrocities happening. These are the tyrannies happening because of conservation. Now, so another challenge is ecological impacts. For example, no cars are limited to inter parks. Roads are constructed to reach wildlife easily. They make money out of it, so they don't care about that ecological impact. For example, one jeep like that entering a crater is $200. Only a jeep So if a jeep has 8 people, an individual paying 2, how much do they make? They make millions of money every day. So you just come, no need, they don't care about ecological impacts, they don't care about construction because they make money. So conservation is a business. Now, conclusion. To me, conservation is a paradox when it excludes people from decisions and evict people from their ancestral land. There is no future for such conservation. Thank you very much for listening.
So I wanted to point out one thing that Killingout talked about is that a lot of times when this concept is introduced to people, people think it's either, okay, if we're trying to figure out a solution going forward, it's either we care about the Maasai or care about the wildlife. It's an either or situation. And I think it's important to just illustrate it's a lot more complicated than that. Oh yeah, so let's say that you've got a protected area here, the national park, and you've consequently excluded the Maasai from that protected area. So now they're living there, whereas they used to live there and be distributed. You've got another protected area over here, which is another key place for wildlife. You exclude the Maasai and you put them here. Now all of a sudden, you've got this big concentration of Maasai in one area, right? Well, the wildlife don't stay here. They migrate through these corridors. And so if you're saying, okay, yeah, we've protected the wildlife, great, we've set aside these areas, that's not true. Because you're putting the Maasai in an area where they have to use more resources than is sustainable, and that directly impacts the wildlife as well. So the form of conservation that's happening, it's like these little nice pretty areas that look beautiful and pristine, but they're not an authentic representation of the broader picture, and they're certainly not an authentic representation of what would happen historically. I feel like it's important to highlight that, because sometimes there's some confusion about it.
Yeah, the other thing that I would like to share before questions to give you another very good understanding is, so let's say, if we have three things. One, conservation of wildlife. Two, tourism, business. Then three is Maasai way of life. Which one has to be the first? That's a very big challenge. Which one has to be the first? So if we say the Maasai have to abandon their way of life for the sake of wildlife conservation, then where will the Maasai's survival comes? And if we say tourism is to be the first one, because they go together, then where is the people? Where will the people survive? In relation that the Maasai don't do agriculture, but if livestock, so this one is livestock. So if livestock is the most important thing for a Maasai people, and the government and conservationists are telling us this is wrong, you have to change, you have to abandon. There is no conservation, and there is no taking care of animals in the national parks or in the areas they go for accessing natural resources. So you have to abandon. So if we are ready to do this, then we need the land. Then we can do agriculture like the rest of human societies, other communities. So we need the land. So where is that land? But the massive livestock with their land have accepted to accommodate wildlife and their livestock at the same time to share the resources from the land. So now it becomes a very, very, very big problem. Because if we need the land for agriculture, I think you divide to individual families, I think even the world Serengeti will not sustain the massive population. But we accept it to accommodate wildlife in the small land or in the land in general for the sake of both of us. But something is wrong, basically wrong. Now, welcome for the questions. Yes?
When we lived in China, there was a big deal about the conservation of the pandas. And they did exactly what you said. The pandas lived on the hillside. They moved the people off the hillside down to the valley. But the pandas' food was on the other hillside, so they had to go through the thick people to get to the other side. They could never make it because they're very shy. They don't ever want to be around people. They just aren't around people. You don't see one in the wild. So they gathered them up, put them into big barracks, and hand bred them. And now they have a huge zoo clear over in Chengdu, away from their area, about 50 miles. And I don't know what's going on over there now, but this was in the 1980s. And there were too many people living in their valley for them to get back and forth. They only eat bamboo. And they need a lot of it.
Why did they move the people?
Off of the land so that they would have more room for the pandas to do their thing. But they have to do it on both sides. It's the nature of it. I don't understand it.
Well, it's similar then.
Yes, it's just like that picture right there.
Well, the important thing to remember when we look at conservation in lots of different areas, in Tanzania as well, is it's basically informed by the American concept of conservation.
Exactly.
The national parks didn't really, it's kind of an American idea, and that went through British colonialism and American colonialism and other forces. So like, when you look at, say, the situation, I don't know specifically about China, but when you look at the situation in Tanzania, it's not like the Tanzanian government sat down and like was like, huh, let's decide how conservation should look. It was like the British said, no, this is it. And that was implied by the American form, which exists because we excluded all people out of natural areas by way of disease and forced evictions. Before, this wouldn't have been a wilderness area. This would have been a place that people flowed through hunting and fishing and migrating through. Same with the entire Columbia Basin. That concept is a fallacy. And that's what's being imported onto these places like Tanzania.
Yeah, we're still doing it. I mean, we just got the wilderness areas here set aside. And now we don't allow any machinery into the wilderness. That would be to clear trails and do all that kind of stuff. That's very interesting. It is really a concept of ours.
Didn't you say it in the middle of this somewhere that the animals, the wild animals, and your cows and things got along, you worked together around
mm-hmm.
there?
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes the cows were eaten or whatever, killed by the lions?
It's not a lot of conflicts.
You could live with
not
it.
Not every day or every week or every month, but it might happen. Maybe twice or three, maybe a year. It depends.
Then you said the elephants interfered with the food raising and things.
Yeah, from other communities, not us.
Not you. That's what I thought. You didn't have elephants.
We have elephants, because we don't do agriculture, so we are not facing the problem.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
worldwide human population is increasing, and I presume that would be the case in this country's country too. And that means that even if you solve the problem for now, it's going to come back because there will be more people and no more land.
And one variable that plays into this as well is access to education and family planning, which I think, I mean, Killing Eye can speak more to that, but my understanding is that as you have access to education in Maasai land, that's changing family dynamics in a way.
Yeah,
you might not have as large a family.
Slow down the increase, but they can still end up being an increase, actually.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we do in Montana, and please correct me, Montana people, if I am wrong, because sometimes I can be very wrong. But with our Native American population, first of all, on the reservation, which you may not like reservations, but on the reservation, Native Americans control their own wildlife, and they can hunt year-round on the reservation if you're a tribal member, and the tribe allows it, because the tribe governs it. And they can hunt year-round on the reservation, any animal. And then once hunting season is open in Montana, a Native American can shoot anything without a license as long as it's on public land and not private. So our Native Americans in Montana do have greater access to the wildlife than non-Native Americans. And again, it's not giving back what they have had, because of course, but it is giving them more of the ability to hunt as they used to. And they're now, with the buffalo in Montana, the excess buffalo from Yellowstone Park, which is being way overrun by buffalo, are now being given to some of the tribes and the reservations, and they're now back raising and having buffalo on the reservation. So I don't know if that fits into your conservation or not, but I know in Montana that's one of the things. And that's all state governed. It's not federal. That's state governed.
Well, they're killing the animals for fun, or to eat.
Mm-hmm. Emily, you had a question as well?
Yeah. I was wondering, Killing Eye, about the relationship between Maasai people and tourists coming in, like if there's any sort of like community tourism, like when tourists come in to the parks, if they're engaging at all, or like if there's any sort of like business that goes on when tourists like go. Because I went on a safari in Tanzania, and on our way out, it was out of the park, we stopped in like a Maasai community, and they were like selling some like jewelry and things. So I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
The point is, the issue of tourism is a complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many people who are doing safaris are the people who know how to do marketing. It's a business that is, I don't know if I'm right, it's a lucrative, I don't know. It's the business that people, someone has to know how to find the client. And the people don't know what is about internet or website designing. And so many people also have to go to a safari trusting some people. Because giving a full package of a safari requires, you know, business partners who can delight the best for you. So there must be trust, there must be a knowledge-based tourism, there must be knowledge-based business. So it's a complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many people don't know about marketing and how to get the people for safaris, for example. But the mass of people are only integrating themselves in the tourism business in a very minor point.
Okay.
So the women or other people sell for people the bracelets, I don't know, the art, you know, cultural artifacts. But also there's a lot of, for example, it's really very interesting to see Sam is doing wood carving. The master has known for a long time, but it's not for this, all the things is, you know, carving. So, but the concept of carving and the taking all the designs of the artifacts has been taken by other people and given, you know, or sold in a high price. But the local people don't know that. They don't know that, so they only maybe depend from selling their small bracelets and necklaces and that kind of things in a smaller context, which is so bargaining. And some people, because maybe the dignity of Maasai is that, you know, they can negotiate, it's very possible that they are taking it, that's why I say in a very small, you know, context. So, but also the singing kind of tourism or cultural tourism, there are so many people interested and they are, you know, their heart is so open, it's so obvious that they need to know about the people. And so many people understand that when we go for cultural tourism of Maasai, it's not because we need to buy their artifacts, or it's not because we need to see their culture, but maybe they leave something behind because when you leave something behind you, you support a family. You support a woman selling for the bracelets, not because you need it, not only you need it because it's so beautiful. No. Some people understand that. And some people do that. If I buy this because I'm supporting someone else to survive. So, but it's a complex thing, but it's happening in Maasai in a small context. It's just in that cultural tourism and they sell those small things, but the big package of safaris is owned by the people who are knowledgeable, who understand and what's it, you know, it's like that.
Is it possible to buy back some of your land, even if the Maasai couldn't afford it, could other people buy back some of the land and give it back to the Maasai? Could they own it? Could the is there a way that the Maasai could ever own some of the land that they've lost?
I don't know. But the point is, the laws about land in Tanzania is crazy. Because the laws, they say that all the public land, all the land is a public land. And the person who is mandatory of giving away that land is the only the president. And this has been a controversial issue about land laws in Tanzania. And that's why so many people who were elected need a new constitution. We are using the constitution of 1970, whereby it's only two people or one person wrote it. And there's a lot of biases. So now that's why the people in my village, we are suffering because it was the president who gave the Arab company to do hunting. So we have no voice because, so if we go to all, you know, passing all bureaucracy offices demanding for our rights, we get hard time because people tell us it's the president who gave them the land. And the president is so powerful. So it's really very hard. But if there was a law that we could sell and we get back, I think it could be maybe another moral judgment to think about. But I don't think so, because of the
law. I mean, in some situations, like, so for example, like some of the parks, the British government made agreements with tribes like the Maasai, saying in X amount of time, you can have your space back. It's like a renewal contract. So they basically said, well, you know, you'll set aside, say, the Serengeti for a set amount of time, but at a certain point there's a promise that you can have access to it again or something like that. Well, if you can find those documents in an international court, and you can raise that up, and people from other countries, namely Western countries, can say, hey, you know, this, and this is legally proves this, there is potentially some traction there. It's so much of Tanzania's economy, NK's economy, is rooted in tourism, which is heavily influenced by foreign opinion of the safety and joys and pleasures of that country. So in that way, that kind of international media actually can have a big influence over it. I mean, I think in 2016, there was a significant amount of aid cut to Tanzania by the U.S. government, specifically because of actions like forced evictions and things like that, that basically the U.S. said, as punishment for you doing things that are not consistent with international code of conduct, we're going to cut your aid. Well, that doesn't hurt the big potatoes in Dar es Salaam or Dodoma or Arusha. That hurts the Maasai.
So it didn't make much of a difference?
Well, it does make a difference in terms of them trying to change their policies, but the immediate impact is actually harm to the local communities. So it's really tough, but I mean, I think that that pathway is an important pathway to pursue. Yeah.
Dylan, what would your vision for the future of your Maasai people be?
Very interesting. That is always a very hard question. But, you know, as the person that we have all the taboos that actually favor a lot of preservation of species, I am afraid about wildlife. I am afraid about wildlife because of the wrong judgment about conservation, but also the decision towards the people's livelihood. So in that kind of understanding, it's giving me an idea of prediction that the Maasai people will survive, but there will be end of wildlife. Because the people now are angry. The people now have a lot of anger, emotion, and they say, if lions are so if now all the problems, all of our sufferings happening because of these animals, so what if we kill them? And it is possible. It is possible to kill these animals. For example, so the Maasai has been helping even scientists in research. So one day, the boys in our village were grazing. So there's one project about research about wild dogs in Serengeti. And these researchers have been researching, and they don't see where are the wild dogs in the national park. And they said, maybe the Maasai boys who are heading might know. So they came to them. Have you seen the wild dogs? The Maasai boy said, yes, we know where they are. So they took them in a small mountain near our village, and they showed them. So these researchers, they found a lot of pits in that mountain that has more than 100 wild dogs. So the same people that has been shown by the Maasai and the wild dogs are existing, tried to draw the map in the interest of extending the national park towards where the wild dogs are living. Mm-hmm. But so now the moral thing is that the wild dogs are living, nobody's killing them. So why do you need to exclude people from living in that area? It's because you need to do a preservation, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the same people drew the map showing that they are going to extend the national park, and you know what happened? they were trying to convince people to move away from that land because for the interest of wildlife. So what the Maasai said, so our generosity, our dignity to show you where they are, now you're moving us away. We are going to kill them. So from the first time in Tanzania reported the wild dogs, 15 of them were poisoned. Only the found one. So nobody knows others died in the jungles and they have never seen. Because some people took a poison to them. So my prediction is that there will be a lot of disasters to our life. Because people are shooting us like animals. Well, there will be suffering to individual families. Well, maybe our livestock will be in the end for our survival. But the people in tropical savannah, the Maasai people, could know how to live in the wilderness without fearing an elephant, without fearing a lion, without fearing a leopard or a wild dog. So what do you think will happen? It is a disaster. The Maasai will survive, but animals will be end. Because we have to look for the way to survive. And that's what people are thinking. They're saying, if animals is a curse to us, we have to kill them. Mm. In order us to stay away from curse. Because they say it's a curse to us. So if we protect them now, it's turning to be a curse for us. Mm. Or maybe the government, like what they are doing, kill all of us. I don't know. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Kilia, you're a teacher.
Yep.
And you've chosen to dedicate a significant portion of your life to education. What do you think is the role of education in this whole issue of conservation and Maasai culture?
The role of education is very powerful. There are some of the things that happen for a reason, like what you said about the international, the UN, the United States, maybe with the veto power about the world, for example, which is an inevitable. So, for example, so when the Maasai leader, traditional leader, came into agreement with the British, in 1904 and in 1911. So the British government made an agreement and these papers were there. So this traditional leader thought that he did one of the very big mistakes toward the Maasai land. But he was hiding these papers. And I can say there are some of the people, despite they had a lot of mentality about colonialism, about colonizing other people, but they were having some ideas that we can say we leave their legacy. For example, the last, I don't know if it's councillor of British in Tanganyika, the last governor of British Tanganyika, when he was handling for independence, he told Nyerere that the wildlife has to be conserved. But if it comes a time that the conflict between wildlife and human collide, give human being the first priority. He told them that. But also in Kenya, what was happening, the oldest son of the Maasai traditional leader inherited the papers of agreement from the British people to his oldest son. And the older son inherited it to another one. So in 2005, it was when people were calculating 100 years of agreement is over. But the all land that was taken by the British, but they have to turn back, he's now the national capital, the big city, the third growing city in Africa, Nairobi, Kenya. But the Maasai were, you know, intervening and, you know, demanding about this historical legacy in courts in London, that the agreement is over. You said you are going to bring the land back. And now we need it. But it's a national park. So it's really very interesting. So when I was in Kenya, I went to see one of my uncle the day in March in 2005, when I was going, so this uncle of mine, because say like, oh, we live in a primitivity kind of life back in Tanzania, in the remote area, so I have to show you the city of Nairobi. I said, well, fine. So when we were going to Nairobi, it was the same week, the master lawyers actually challenged the British in London, and the British government accepted to give billions of euro to Maasai people, but also some part of land at the same time. So when the Maasai now won this kind of heroism, the Kikuyu people said that because they are the part of the land that they were, the Maasai have to regain back, started a massacre against the Maasai people. So the day I was going to Nairobi was the day people were cut off from the public transports, the Maasai people. And it was happening because in the junction going to Nairobi, there are two, so the road from Naivasha, the road from Narok, then meeting Mai Mahiu, go to Nairobi. So these guys from Mai Mahiu, it is where the British, the agreement to all Nairobi started. So what happened is that when we were going with a public bus, we had the news that the Kikuyu are cutting the Maasai off their head. And I was curious to understand why. It was not my country. So I was told the story of London. And it happened because of those guys they went to educate. So education is the most powerful thing that can also help some people to see their rights, to see their freedom, to see their jurisdictional natural laws. That how much the doctrine natural laws actually favor an individual, it doesn't matter where you are, but you have the doctrine natural laws to live the way you're living. So that is some of the things happening. And education is so powerful. One of my favorite person in Kenya is a Maasai guy who was educated. His name is Wole Sangan. He went to study in Kenya, but he was given to be a chairman of Kenyan Airways for so long time. So from the grassroots, he brought the company, the government company of Airways, from the ground and so successful in East and Central Africa. But when he was retired, he went, this journalist wanted to interview him. How did you do? Tell us the quest of your life, everything that you do to the country, to the airline. He gave them the story, and he was asking, what are you doing now? He said, look to my grandma, I'm living with my cows. Because the mentality of culture of a person will never go away. I can change and put on American pants, but the mentality in my heart about my culture will never fade. So education is a powerful weapon. I see right now. Any other question?
Before we leave, could you give us a blessing in your own language? Or could you say something?
Okay, yeah, so let's give the last, and then I give a blessing in the language. Yeah, that would be very nice.
Mm-hmm. And I'll also say before we go, there's some forms to give us feedback about the sessions. So if anyone would be willing to fill that out, that would be very helpful for us.
Thank you.
Are you having water wars going on with the continent, the park and the...
Mm-hmm.
Did I hear you say?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Water is very scarce.
Is there less now? I mean, are you seeing global change?
It's not like that.
No.
It's like all, you know, like all the national parks that also is so prone with availability of enough water should at the same time only feed up all wild animals, but not people with domestic use and also with their domestic animals. So that's the irony happening. So it's like that. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so I have to bless. when a person with an elder say bless and do that is so nice to remind me something. Yeah, so jo mayen kai nigin jo ngeno jo injangai andosidai nimo ronana jo injangai alrao anana nimelo jo injangai enyohata e bokitoki nanwe si unangisho Radia will need to do a and guy. A shit. Thank you. I don't know. I'll be sorry. So, let God give you love. That is in your brother. Love in your mom. So, go with in your heart. Go with love. And your daughter, well with love.
Thank you, Kilgore.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So what can we do? I mean, what's our role in this kind of thing as far as supporting positive change in some of these issues?